Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. Disrespect's producer was unwell last week, but the state of Ontario's fixed incomes is unwell with regard to livability. Last year at this time, we interviewed Willie Noyles on the accretion of taxes on working and fixed incomes. Here he is.
We were both interested in talking about some of the influences of things that are happening now, like the potential for increase in health costs through the restrictions on pharmacies, the HST, which has already come into effect as of May the 1st for some services, and the hydro hike that's already happened, apparently 10%, and more to come next year.
Yeah.
And we're looking at all this, and we're hearing we know that your HST rebate is going to be less than the GST rebate, and all the merchants are going to generously give you back all the money they've saved with the HST.
We're supposed to believe that eventually down the road that prices will come down.
Competition will do that.
It's just like the trickle-down theory. We just have to keep waiting for some of that money to actually trickle down.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm looking up. I don't see it yet, but maybe...
Probably never will.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe it's a long way away, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Well, the facts that I have are... 8% on theater packages, airplane tickets, gym memberships, anything that continues after July the 1st, the day that the HST is applied to even more things in the province for an increase on things that don't now bear the provincial sales tax. And electricity rates in Ontario have risen almost 10% effective this coming Saturday. What's the date for that? This is the third. Our show is on the 4th to 6th. And Saturday's the 8th, okay. They're saying 10%. And Canadians are wary of their future purchasing power. None more so, by the way, than people with fixed incomes.
Exactly, because they're the ones that can least afford all this stuff.
Yeah. According to the Conference Board of Canada, consumer confidence fell a surprising 7.8 points this month to 84.8, the lowest since December. And the Ontario and BC governments are supposed to be feeling a backlash. I think BC's feeling a stronger backlash because they're the ones who made the promise that they wouldn't do this. Before the last election, one of the planks of Campbell's election was that he was not going to do the HST. And immediately, within days after being elected, they opened lines to the federal government to get those billions. I think it's $1.6 billion is the first payment. And that's the day after we broadcast Friday, May the 7th. That they get the first $1.6 billion if they've got their ducks in a row in their own legislature. It's a powerful incentive. Doesn't seem to be an incentive to tell the truth, though.
No, and my biggest concern about all this is that this money's not... All this extra cost that people are going to bear is not going to help the bottom line for the government because they've already thrown the money out the door for tax cuts.
You mean like a business tax cuts?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's very much a pro-business government. It seems we've elected some blue liberals.
Yeah. Because all these guys are just basically Mike Harris light.
Mike Harris light. I don't know. Maybe Mike Harris was Dalton McGuinty light is the way it's beginning to look. You know, depends whether you're talking about attitude or results, you know.
Yeah.
McGuinty's taken this further than Harris ever did.
But yeah, in many ways he has.
Yeah, but he's been nicer about it, you know?
Yeah.
He's used a sharper knife, and he hasn't twisted it so far. He's just sunk it deeper and deeper and deeper.
Yeah, he almost has kind of like what Cretchan did, the, I hate to do this, but we have to.
Yeah, yeah, right. Cancel the GST. How many billions of dollars? Are you kidding? Grow up. You know, yeah. Yeah, I remember that well. Where's Sheila Copps when you need her?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, well, it also looks as if, according to the Canadian press, consumers and taxpayers don't know if they're going to receive their transition checks up to $1,000 per family starting in June. Now, these are not $1,000 checks. These are dribbled into their hands supposedly starting in June.
Yeah.
I don't know if the government's ready to issue these. And I don't know if, I mean, if they were sensible, they'd be in addition to the HST rebate checks. But I don't know if they are. And if it were sensible, they'd be in addition to the GST rebate checks, but I can't find that out either.
Yeah, and even the government's own website on the HST says nothing about what happens to the GST rebate.
Not our department, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. And that will be the big thing, because if the GST rebate is no more, people are going to be further behind than they were before.
You mean further behind than Mike Harris put them, plus 18 years of falling further behind.
Yeah.
That's a lot of years, and that's a lot of behind.
Mm-hmm. Now, the government's trying to propose that because they're going to be doing this, they're in addition to that $1,000 per family or $300 for an individual, that what they're going to do is have this new permanent Ontario sales tax credit that is supposed to help everybody, but basically the maximum you can get is $65 every 4 months.
Oh, that's it, eh? $65.
Yeah, which comes to $260 over the entire year. When you consider
that's how much... 65 times... 4 months into a year is three, so 65 times three is 195. So we're talking... we must be talking $80 three times, and not every 4 months. The word I have it is, you know, everybody has a different
quarterly
story.
Quarterly starting August 2010.
And skipping the spring when you get your income tax refund is what I've heard.
Okay.
Yeah. That's only what I've heard, you know. I heard it from a government source, but hey, they're the ones with all the good news lately, so I don't know. Yeah. So, yeah, $80 instead of your $100 or your $95 that you're getting off the GST won't be a very good deal.
No, and especially when you consider all the extra stuff that you're now going to be paying an extra sales tax on that you never did before.
Yeah. Well, I guess if you can consider a 10% increase in hydro and then...
the HST on top of that.
And the HST on top of that, which is another almost 10%. And then you can figure it on most of the other things that you don't pay PST on. I don't know, pick a figure, but it strikes me the food banks are going to see another bump, and they're already going crazy.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe this is a good time for them to introduce it, right, so that people don't want to get violent over the wintertime, but it could be a violent spring.
Yeah.
It could be a violent election.
Yep.
People just insisting that, you know, they're entitled to enough to live and asking for it from the government in which they paid all those years that they worked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, what the government's hoping is that with incentive checks, they're giving these transition checks that basically is your own money coming back at you. But they're hoping that because you get that last one just a few months before the next election, that you'll forgive them. So yeah. You'll get that last $100 if you're a single person, and for a family, what is it? I think it's about $300.
Yeah.
That you'll get that just before the next election, and that suddenly will...
Before they drop you in the ship.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I like to think that voters are smarter than that.
Well, I'd like to think they would focus on the fact that it is the last of the checks, you know?
Yeah.
And then comes the election. Haven't we been good to you? Show us how grateful you are.
And then they'll probably make some promises in that last budget like they did the last time, that if you elect us by 2017.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
And we're still studying poverty, and we still intend to raise the fixed income rates.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, we raised the minimum wage to more than $10 an hour.
Yeah, and that's the last it'll be raised probably for quite a while now.
Yes, I think so. And everybody's on cut hours because of the recession, so the raise to $10 an hour doesn't really accomplish much if you're only working 28 hours a week.
No, exactly, and
all it
we're
does
all
is
paying for that now anyway, because most stores out there have already bumped up their prices to take to cover the extra cost of their minimum wage hike.
Yeah, well, imagine that you've worked somewhere for 10 years to get to $10 an hour, and that somebody with a fondness for bubblegum and not yet out of high school comes in at $10 an hour to talk with their boyfriend or girlfriend instead of work.
Yeah, because I know a number of people who used to be making just a little bit more than the minimum wage, but now they're just making minimum wage.
Yeah, and there's no allowance or compensation or recognition of how hard these people have worked to get to minimum wage, you know?
No, exactly.
Yeah. And they're going to be angry. Not all of them now are able to eat at 28
no,
hours a week.
No, and most of them, if they have a problem, will take it out with their employer.
And mandating reasonable living
compensation. The most ironical thing about all this, though, is that the people who are going to get hit the most are, like you say, the people who are struggling on a fixed income. And they're also the same people who, not 18 months ago, were told about better days were coming because we have this poverty reduction plan.
And, you know, what, 12 months later, they appointed people to a panel?
Yeah. And the panel's already been given a very limited scope.
Oh, I didn't know that. Tell us about that.
One of the things that the 25 and 5 looked at was trying to get that $100 healthy food supplement into this last budget.
Right.
And they presented it to the expert panel, and the expert panel told them they weren't allowed to look at that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They had to go back to the minister.
Madeleine Mayer.
Yes. And she said that they could look at it, but of course, by the time she said they could look at it, the budget was only 2 weeks away from being announced anyway, so it was all for naught.
Okay.
And yet that $100 a month, while it's not a whole great deal, that $100 a month could have helped a lot of people.
Make a big difference.
Yeah.
I mean, and it affects more people than they realize.
At the end of the day, it wouldn't have affected the government that much. And it would have been a sign, a gesture at least, that we're intending to make some progress.
Yeah, yeah.
And instead, no, what did they do? They hacked the special diet allowance.
Yeah. And again, you know, there's this problem of transparency, which we have with the HST and the GST. And now we have it with the special diet. Who's going to be on the special diet? I'm told that I'm going to be grandfathered on the special diet. I don't believe a word of it.
No, I wouldn't either.
I was told that by someone working for ODSP. I don't believe a word of it.
No, because the Ministry of Consumer or Community and Social Services isn't going to have anything to do with the new allowance.
That's true, too.
It's sort of the Ministry of Health. They're the ones who are going to determine it.
Yeah. Yeah, and how are they going to save money if 20% of the people on the benefits are already on the special diet? How are they going to save the money on the ones that are left to qualify? Granted, there are people who need it and will qualify. I can't believe it's another 20%. So they can't be going to save much money if they only give this to the new people. And I can't believe that they're not going to give it to everybody, the reduction in special diet.
Well, I think they're going to have to. And my guess is probably what's going to happen is everybody's going to have to reapply for it.
Well,
and there'll probably be new criteria.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and my guess is the amount that they're giving will not be what people are getting now.
Oh, well, there wouldn't be any saving if it was the amount they're getting now, would it?
Exactly.
Yeah. Fish out your dented cans of tuna. Where's David Sabucci?
Yeah, exactly.
He at least wanted us to be able to afford dented cans of tuna, you know? I mean, we thought that was miserable then, but some of us would be glad to have the guy now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And now you deserve a break. Jimmy Thackeray, Detroit Iron. You've been listening to View Magazine columnist Willie Noyles talk about the coming burdens for people on fixed incomes, the 10% increase in energy tax, the 8% increase on VAT in HST, the coming increase in drug costs, and the canceling of the special diet for people who need the money to eat.
Maybe this just doesn't affect middle Canada, the 905 and so forth. Maybe they just don't, you know, despite the fact it's in the papers every day, despite the fact that many of their customers are these people who are going to suffer and their businesses are going to suffer as a result, they don't seem to get it, that there's something going on that they should be concerned about.
I know. And the sad thing is that for some reason, despite all the news about poverty, it's still not a popular issue that has attracted the mainstream attention.
I guess, yeah. Maybe they don't believe it?
Or they don't want to?
Yeah. I'm told that the psychological impact of acceptance of that is quite steep, that with it, you have to accept a certain amount of guilt and a certain amount of shame and a certain amount of regret that you've come to the party too late to solve some of the damage that's already been done. And maybe people aren't willing to do that.
And
I don't know. When it's their own kids, maybe they will. You know, kids graduating from university in the middle of a recession, not eligible for EI. What do they get? Kick in the ass.
Yeah, those are the kids I feel sorry for the most, actually.
Yeah. Well, those are the ones who are going back home and saying, Mom, Dad, I haven't got enough to rent a place and I haven't got enough to eat. And their parents, if they have half a brain, will be saying, well, doesn't the government provide you with money? Isn't the government supporting you? And the kid's explaining that, no, well, it's only $500 and some odd a month. And and Mom and Dad going, well, can't you make that stretch? And the kid's going, well, apartments are $600, you know. I'm sorry, you know, I can't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe the recession will bring it home.
Not to mention all the people who once were middle class who are now unemployed and are basically exhausting their EI waiting until they have to go on to welfare themselves.
Yeah. Well, some of them apparently already are. In Hamilton, the EI numbers are down, but the welfare numbers are up.
Yeah, same with here in Niagara.
Yeah. Well, you've got the new engine plant coming in. That's something, I guess. Is it engines?
I'm trying to remember what it is.
Yeah, well, the new GM plant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But my guess is all it's going to do is basically bring back some of the people who were laid off the last time around.
Yeah.
And avoid any more layoffs there.
Okay. Yeah. We can expect a certain amount of social disruption ranging from aggressive protesting to violence from people who figure at this point they have nothing left to lose.
Yeah, the ones like the OCAP people.
Yeah, the ones who really have nothing left to lose, the ones who are already homeless, are probably they probably don't have the energy for this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Then the people one notch above them, the people who live on fixed incomes and are not quite making the pieces of the puzzle fit, but they still have their wits about them and they still have their initiative and they still have their dignity and they resent attempts to strip them of all of the above. Those people will probably be organizing in ways we haven't even imagined.
No, actually I wouldn't be surprised because really there's only so many times you can be smacked down before you just finally have enough and just take lawlessness into your own hands. I don't advocate that, but I can see where somebody could get to that point where they would.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the Liberals reach out for communications with their public and with their so-called supporters, and occasionally I seem to fall under that umbrella, although through no fault of my own. And when the word goes back, I always say, remember the Federal Progressive Conservative Party. And I think we may see something like that. Unfortunately, I think you characterize them as Timmy Hudak is waiting in the wings to clean up that vote. And that's not a pleasant prospect either.
No, it's really the best we can hope for in the next election is that if people are going to punish the Liberals, that they elect enough New Democrats to at least make it a minority government.
Yeah, and the New Democrats wear the pants in the legislature.
Yeah. Well, at least with the minority government, things wouldn't be as bad, and the government of the day would have to listen to the NDP to stay in power. Now, and the last time we had a really great government in Ontario was between 85 and 87 when Peterson had to rely on Bob Rae to get through the day.
Yeah.
Whether we can actually be lucky enough to get another minority, I'm not sure.
We've sort of outlined what the best scenario is and the outlook for any other scenario and the social consequences of it. It doesn't look good for business and industry in Ontario. I mean, this is, you know, a province riven by social unrest is not the place the new high-tech companies want to locate.
No.
They don't want to locate in BC either, if that's what's going to happen there. And I suspect, at least in Vancouver, that's what is. I don't know. Basically, where does that leave us? All the new tech going to Alberta.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dalton.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well,
that's the part that still makes me shake my head, is why he would introduce this kind of stuff during the middle of the worst recession we've had in eons.
Mm-hmm.
Because none of this is going to get us out of the recession, despite all the government PR to the contrary. I don't think it's going to have the effect of stimulating the economy, because people are going to now be even more conscious about what they buy, because they're going to know that there's going to be that extra dollar or $3 or whatever on whatever good they buy now.
Well, the federal conservatives had it right. They wanted to dole out money to shovel-ready projects, but the birth of green energy technology as a homegrown Ontario product is not shovel-ready.
No.
Despite the publicity I've heard given to automated pharmacy dispensers, I don't look forward to going down at midnight when you're out of heart pills or something, or your insulin, and finding the machines on the blink, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know that that's shovel-ready either. The only thing that's shovel-ready is taking the money out of people's pockets with the HST. It is not an optimistic scenario. But the best one is, I think you've hit on it, the best one is the minority government.
Yeah.
So I don't know how we engineer that. I suppose instead of playing, you know, the usual, what do they call that, that process by which NDP voters vote Liberal because they're afraid of conservatives?
Strategic voting.
Yeah. So we abandon strategic voting for a change and vote for the people that we want.
Yeah.
All of us, including Tim Hudak's people. And, you know, maybe we get a minority PC or a minority Liberal government. And in either case, the NDP hold all the cards. And the rest of us, maybe we can take a few short panic breaths and hope that, you know, the good news continues, that we don't have a legislature struck with repeated new votes and repeated calls for, you know, new confidence in the government that end up only with other minorities.
Yeah.
Like we have federally.
Yeah, unfortunately, federally, we had that good period in the last part of Paul Martin's minority, and ever since then, because the different players involved, namely the autocrat, Mr. Harper, minority governments have not functioned the way they could traditionally.
Yeah. Well,
because he's governing in many ways like he has a majority. And then, of course, you've got the Liberals, who have been so demoralized and have such a poor leadership that they're just basically sitting on their hands when votes go by, so they're not even holding the government to account.
Yeah, so the honest brokerage of a minority government is something of a bygone thing at the moment.
At the moment, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe we can show the rest of the country how it's done in Ontario and BC.
Yeah.
That would be a good thing. So get out there and get out to vote, volunteer your labor, whatever you want to do, protest, mobilize.
And vote,
for God's sake, yeah.
Yeah, because unfortunately that's the one thing that happens, is that the people that are the most impacted by all this stuff tend to be the ones who don't vote.
Really? And why do you figure that is?
I think maybe because they've gotten so knocked down over the years that they've just gotten to the point that they're just apathetic, and they figure it doesn't matter who gets elected, they're going to get screwed anyway.
Yeah. Well, How do you like it? Is it good for you this way? Is it good for you that way? At least you get to pick who screws you,
uh-huh.
and you have some say in how they do it. And that alone is worth showing out to vote. I don't want to be overly cynical, but it's not to be underrated, your choice of partner. If we keep all the parties on their toes with minorities, and we can do that for any length of time, then we have more say than we normally would.
Yeah.
Get out there and vote. Any other advice, Willie?
Boy. I guess the one thing I would say to people is just remember all this stuff the next time you go to vote. Don't have amnesia before the election, because I'm sure the government's going to come out with all kinds of wonderful promises and everything else to try and make you forgive them for what they've done to you.
Yeah.
Don't buy it.
Yeah. So don't
just go. Just because you get a $100 check in June of 2011 doesn't mean that the government is suddenly changing a new leaf.
Isn't that the truth? All right, I appreciate your coming on the line on your own time in the evening tonight, and as always, I appreciate your point of view, your inside perspective.
No problem, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
All right, thanks, Willie.
Thank you.
And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These are not the stories that we read to you from the newspapers. These are condensations or abbreviations of the articles from the papers that we identify in the broadcast. Here's $5.92. Make it last a month. According to Finance Minister Dwight Duncan, the cost of living will rise by 2.3% in Ontario. Welfare rates will increase by 1%. That means an individual who is now living on $592 a month, including $368 for shelter and $224 for everything else, will get $597.92 starting in November. That is 61% below the poverty line set by the National Council of Welfare. A single mother raising a child will get an additional $10.14 a month, bringing her welfare check up to $1,024. That falls 45% below the poverty line. There wasn't a cent in the recent Ontario budget for food or housing, for that matter. The province's 2011 fiscal plan guarantees that the 850,000 Ontarians who depend on social assistance, the poorest people in the province, will fall further behind this year. Anti-poverty activists took what little comfort they could from the threadbare document. It proposed replacing three quarterly tax credits, the Ontario Sales Tax Credit, the Ontario Energy and Property Tax Credit, and the Northern Energy Credit, with a single monthly benefit designed to help low-income families manage their bills. And it contained help for children with mental health problems, a $76 million investment in better programs and services. They had hoped for more. A food supplement, a shelter allowance, job training. But they dared not criticize the Liberal government too harshly, fearing worse if the Conservatives are elected this fall. It would be easy to blame Premier Dalton McGuinty for turning his back on the poor. But political leaders reflect public opinion, especially in an election year. The Premier seems to have read the mood of Ontarians correctly. What happened? How did a province that resolved 4 years ago to tackle poverty lose its will? The recession was obviously a factor. But that isn't the whole explanation. After the recession, fiscal discipline leaped to the top of the political agenda. That gave the edge to cost-cutters such as Tim Hudak and Rob Ford. It forced middle-of-the-road politicians such as McGuinty to tack right or risk losing public support. The media, sensing that poverty reduction was a spent force, stopped writing about it, asking about it, thinking about it. The anti-poverty movement was stymied. Having persuaded McGuinty to adopt targets and timelines rather than raise welfare rates, it was trapped when the Premier brought in a poverty reduction plan with ambitious targets but failed to act on it. The coalition's leaders had misplaced their trust, but were loath to admit it. The churches and charities, faced with rising need and falling donations, were too overwhelmed to speak out. They didn't know where to turn. Clearly not to Queen's Park. But sadly, not to the people of Ontario. And The Star by Carol Gore. And a letter to the editor, taxes now higher for pensioners, poor, re-federal election. Since 2006, the federal conservatives have quietly and quickly introduced tax increases that affect pensioners and the poor. After emphatically stating the conservatives would never raid the hard-earned pensions of retirees in October 2006, less than 10 months after taking office, the Stephen Harper conservatives introduced a tax on income trusts. This set the entire income trust industry into a tailspin. This is the year when this tax comes into effect. This was a betrayal of a promise by Stephen Harper. Again, starting in 2006, the Conservatives attacked the poorest people in Canada, raising the tax rate on the lowest tax bracket to 15.5% after the Liberals cut it to 15% from 16% in November 2005. At the same time, the Conservatives also lowered corporate taxes. I am being kind when I say the Harper Conservatives are disingenuous when they tell us the Liberals are the only ones who raise taxes. That from the Hamilton Spectator, Nick Houston in Dundas. Councillors in Durham weigh in on a heavy issue. His pockets have been emptied of O. Henry bars and he's lacing up his walking shoes. Oshawa Mayor John Henry is tackling his weightiest issue yet, dropping 15 pounds. He joins a 30-day challenge to raise money for the hungry. Henry and several councillors stepped on the scales at Oshawa City Hall to launch a campaign in which every dollar per pound pledged will go to Feed the Need, Durham Region's food distribution warehouse. "We're going to have some fun with it," Henry said, threatening to deliver pastries to Oshawa Council. Hijinks aside, it's a welcome spotlight on a growing problem, said Sandy Britton, executive director of Feed the Need, which provides emergency food to 46 agencies that run shelters, soup kitchens, and food banks. The state of hunger in Ontario, 402,000 Ontarians a month rely on food banks. 68% depend on social assistance, including 45% on Ontario Works and 23% on the Ontario Disability Support Program. 5% are pensioners. 11% have employment income. 64% live in private rental housing. Single adults are the largest group of food bank users, accounting for 38%. Single parent families are the second largest group of users, accounting for 30%. So who are you going to vote for in the fall? That in the Star by Carola Vinak, urban affairs reporter. More seniors land in bankruptcy. 16% in 2010 were grandpa debtors. Canadian seniors are declaring bankruptcy at an alarming rate, says a bankruptcy study released by trustees Hoyes, Miklos, and Associates. "We've noticed an increase in the number of insolvent debtors over the age of 55, said Douglas Hoyes, a chartered accountant and bankruptcy trustee. In 2010, 16% of debtors who filed for a proposal of bankruptcy were so-called grandpa debtors, up from 12.5% in 2008, says the study. One of the alarming trends Mr. Hoy sees is a rising number of Canadians entering retirement with debt or already retired citizens assuming new debt just to make ends meet. While some of this debt is housing related, a lot is bad credit card debt. Mr. Hoy's found grandpa debtors owed an average $73,878 in unsecured debt, 24% more than the average Canadian. The study finds 47% of grandpa debtors live on their own, while 9% are widowed and 30% divorced or separated at the time of their insolvency. Nearly 37% still have a dependent at home. Seniors retiring with debt had $74,000 of it on average versus $59,800 for the average mainstream insolvent citizen. Seniors carried more than $37,000 in credit card debt spread over five different cards versus just $24,400 spread over credit cards for the average insolvent person. In addition, some seniors don't reduce living expenses in accord with reduced retirement income, while many also suffer from loneliness and compensate by shopping or gambling. Finally, because of the recession, many seniors are providing significant financial assistance to adult children, some of them unemployed, 40-year-olds with families of their own. And that from the Financial Post by Jonathan Chevreau. Bigger food crops, no match for rising demand. Global food prices fell for the first time in nearly a year in March, but the reprieve won't last long and prices are already heading back up, even as farmers plant more crops than ever. This week, last week, corn hit a record high of $7.73 U.S. a bushel on the Chicago Board of Trade, while wheat and soybeans have jumped as much as 8% in the past few days. Farmers in the United States are expected to plant some of the largest corn and soybean crops in history, according to figures released by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Growers in Brazil and Argentina have also enjoyed bumper harvests, and wheat production is up in China, Russia, and the Ukraine. India is also enjoying strong rice harvests. Corn is by far the most important crop grown in the United States, and the price is being driven by three factors: ethanol production, exports to China, and demand from cattle ranchers. All three are showing no sign of slowing despite record prices. Ethanol is expected to consume up to 40% of the U.S. corn crop. China keeps buying boatloads, and cattle ranchers can afford to pay more for feed because meat prices are pushing record highs. "We have very tight stocks in corn," said Jerry Klassen, a Winnipeg-based commodity analyst at Gap SA Grains and Products. He said corn needs to go from its current $7.73 to $9 or $10 a bushel before demand would be significantly affected. That's the price where ranchers in particular would start to find other feed alternatives. All the added production can barely keep up with demand. On the same day the USDA predicted farmers will grow near record crops of corn and soybeans, the agency said inventories of both are plummeting. The excess supply of corn has dropped 15% in the past year and is at a 15-year low. Soybean inventories are at record lows, and both crops are expected to remain in tight supply this year. Canola inventories are also down, leaving wheat as one of the few major grains still in decent supply, but that could change as farmers switch from wheat to more lucrative crops. Low inventories also mean food prices will be vulnerable to even minor disruptions such as flooding or drought, said David Sparling, chair of Agri-Food Innovation and Regulation at the Richard Ivey School of Business. Mr. Sparling added that consumers should get used to long-term food inflation. "I don't think there's any doubt that we're going to be seeing higher prices," he said. "Everything is aligned." That by Paul Waldy, the Globe and Mail report on business. Indelec's pension decision has far-reaching implications. Employees of insolvent companies will have a better chance of collecting their pensions after a surprise court decision transformed the law around corporate bankruptcies in Ontario. The Ontario Court of Appeal ruled in favor of a failed manufacturer's staff that was seeking to use the proceeds from the sale of the company's assets to cover shortfalls in their underfunded pension plans. Pension plan members are usually last in the lineup of creditors when an employer goes under and often lose their retirement nest eggs. But the court upset that traditional pecking order, and its decision has ramifications well beyond the aluminum company, Indelex, which had a $6.7 million pension shortfall when it filed for creditor protection under Canada's Federal Companies Creditors Arrangement Act in 2009, and implications and ramifications well beyond Ontario. Indelex knew that the plans were underfunded and that unless more funds were put into the plans, pensions would have to be reduced, the court said in a decision written by Madam Justice Eileen Gillese, who is known as one of Canada's foremost pension law experts. The decisions that Indelex was unilaterally making had the potential to affect the plan's beneficiaries' rights at a time when they were particularly vulnerable. Pensioners' vulnerability to bankruptcy proceedings drew attention during the recession of 2008 and 2009, when corporate failures spiked and pension plans across the country faced shortfalls estimated at $50 billion during the worst of the downturn. Over the past few years, high-profile insolvencies at such companies as Nortel, Abitibi Bowater, Fraser Papers, Slater Steel, and Canwest Global Communications left employees with reduced pensions. The Ontario Court of Appeal ruling could change that trend, however, by setting higher standards for companies when dealing with pensioners. The ruling means that companies in a CCAA proceeding cannot automatically ignore an underfunded pension plan. Instead, companies will have to first make a case in court that they cannot meet their pension obligations. Companies can't ignore pensioners in insolvency proceedings, and they have to take steps to deal with pension deficiencies, said Andrew Hatney, a lawyer with Kosky Minsky, LLP, who represented 16 former managers and executives of the company who were facing a 60% cut to their pension income. The ruling is a wake-up call for companies in bankruptcy protection, he said. He said it was not clear the ruling would always send pension plan members to the front of the line during an insolvency proceeding. This would seem to change the landscape quite a bit, said Toronto pension lawyer Hugh O'Reilly, who represented the actuarial firm appointed as the administrator of the Indilex pension plans. And that by Jeff Gray and Janet McFarland, with a report from Greg Keenan in the Globe and Mail. McGuinty demands Ottawa provide energy subsidies. Challenging MPs of all political stripes to stand up for Ontario, Premier Dalton McGuinty has plunged into the federal election campaign with demands for energy subsidies from Ottawa. His call comes in the wake of pledges by Conservative leader Stephen Harper and Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff to provide a $4.2 billion loan guarantee for Newfoundland and Labrador's Lower Churchill Hydro Project. Ontarians should understand that 40% of the federal government's money comes directly from Ontarians, McGuinty told reporters at Queen's Park on Monday. When it comes to support from the federal government for energy projects, Ontario is looking for equal treatment, he said. While Harper hasn't commented, a senior Conservative told the Star that Ottawa is open to other clean energy projects in all regions of Canada. While Ontario is embarking on a 20-year, $87 billion long-term energy plan, including $33 billion for new nuclear reactors, $27 billion toward renewable green energy, and $9 billion in new transmission lines, McGuinty would not put a price tag on his demand. We'll wait and see what the numbers translate into. What I'm saying is what's good for the goose is good for the gander, he said. That story by Robert Benzie, Queen's Park Bureau Chief, and Bruce Campion-Smith, the Ottawa Bureau Chief in the Toronto Star, Tuesday, April 5th. Home care sees too little cash, critics say. 30% of funding goes to bureaucracy. Ontario's home care system's too bureaucratic, with too much public funding going toward administration and case management costs, and not enough to frontline services, a healthcare watchdog group charges. Public funds are transferred through four separate levels of administration before any money reaches the front lines of care, says a report by the Ontario Health Coalition. Home care funding passes from the Health Ministry to Ontario's 14 regional local health integration networks, LHINs, which oversee delivery of care. From the LHINs, money flows to the province's 14 Community Care Access Centres, CCACs. The access centres, in turn, allot funding to home care provider agencies. This means there are multiple tiers of administration for home care, more than any other healthcare sector, says the report, a copy of which was obtained by the Star. The CCACs spend $500 million a year, or 30% of their budgets, on administration and case management, according to the coalition, which questions whether taxpayers are getting good value for the money. The provincial auditor highlighted some of these same problems in his annual report last fall. In the federal election campaign that's underway, Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff and NDP leader Jack Layton are both calling for better home care services. Earlier this year, the Star published a series titled Begging for Care, highlighting how the province's aging at home strategy is failing to help seniors stay healthy enough to stay home and avoid admission to hospitals or nursing homes. The coalition is calling on the province to review the way it awards contracts to agencies that provide home care services. And that by Teresa Boyle, health reporter for The Star. Ontario's scary debt numbers. In his PowerPoint speeches, Premier Dalton McGuinty shows off a chart playing down Ontario's deficit troubles compared to other countries. Behind closed doors, however, the province's financial brain trust has been shown a different slideshow, one that casts the rapidly rising debt in a darker light. Ontario has fallen embarrassingly behind most other provinces. The bearer of this bad news is the little-known Ontario Financing Authority, whose mission is to keep the province solvent by ensuring a constant cash flow. It avoids the limelight while shining a light on Ontario's high-stakes deficit dance. The net debt after accounting for assets comes to $220 billion, or about $17,000 for every man, woman, and child. Unprecedented increase in new debt and refinancing leads to a substantial increase in both financing and interest rate risks in the future, the OFA's audit service team notes tersely. An influential credit rating agency, Standard & Poor's, has put the province on notice that its credibility is in question. Interest paid on Ontario's debt for the 2010-11 fiscal year ending this month will be nearly $10 billion. That's 8% of total government expenditures. In 2010, with Ontario saddled by debt that's reached 36% of GDP, gross domestic product, Ontario's debt is higher than any province except Nova Scotia and Quebec. On a per capita basis, Ontario's borrowing more debt than any province except New Brunswick. $2,100 per capita in 2010 and 11. The numbers are depressing but not surprising. Ontario didn't boost the debt on a whim. It deliberately primed the pump during a brutal recession to keep the auto industry afloat and the economy on life support, just as the federal government did. Though Ottawa boasts a higher credit rating and vows to end its deficit sooner. Now time has run out because the money has run out. Time, perhaps, to give the full slideshow. That by Martin Reg Kahn in Thursday, March 24th's Toronto Star. Better late than never, the report from March 21st in the Globe and Mail. Ontario to cover cancer patients' drug cost. Health Minister changes stance on Herceptin covered by other provinces for patients with small tumors. A confrontation between patients and government over access to a potentially life-saving cancer treatment is set to end with an announcement that Ontario will join other provinces and provide expanded access. This is the option that I think makes real sense to me, Ontario Health Minister Deb Matthews said in a telephone interview over a new program to be announced. We owe it to people who have a rare condition, or a condition that doesn't fit into the established criteria. Ontario's ombudsman decided to investigate whether the government's decision to restrict the drug from such patients was informed and reasonable. What it really came down to, however, was one question best answered by medical oncologists and scientists. Are breast cancer patients with small HER2 tumors at a high risk of recurrence? The risk is almost 1.5 to 2-fold higher risk of recurrence, Stephen Chia, chair of the British Columbia Breast Tumor Group, said of HER2 positive breast cancer patients compared to HER2 negative patients with similar sized smaller tumors. In HER2 positive cancers, it's not the size that drives it, it's the HER2 gene that drives it. In the case of Jill Anzarut, her oncologist had recommended Herceptin and made a special request to the province, which was denied. The Toronto mother of two has already undergone breast-conserving surgery and has begun chemotherapy. It was recommended she start the drug in May. Those designing clinical studies wanted to get their answer on whether Herceptin worked as soon as possible, so they focused on patients at the highest risk of recurrence in the 5 years after surgery, which were patients with cancers that had spread to the lymph nodes. Those with tumors of 1 centimeter or less were not able to participate. When asked if the case of Ms. Anzarut revealed a gap in the system, Ms. Matthews said, "For me, yes, and there have been others as well that forced me to look at that gray zone." That gray zone, she said, are those patients who do not fit clinical guidelines for a given treatment, but for whom there is building medical evidence suggesting a drug may be of benefit. That story by Lisa Priest in the Globe and Mail, March 21st. And that's the news for Disrespect this week. Come on back next week. There will be more. And we're going out with Jimmy Thackeray, Bullfrog. If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.